Our next speaker, Dr. Joel Leyenbauer, comes from a distinguished family. His father is a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and served as the president of the New England District. And Dr. Joel Leyenbauer was the assistant and then the associate secretary or director of the commission, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Commission on Theology. I actually was there and a member of that group when he was promoted from assistant director to associate director. Isn't that true? I can't say that was a particularly meaningful occasion. And in the words of Bill Weinrich, who's not the most original thinker, was not the mountain to die on if you had any objections. But he has served admirably very well in that situation. We chose Joel, Dr. Leyenbauer, because he wrote his dissertation on Stanley Hauerwas. Now, we've heard lots of, I've never met Hauerwas. I've read some of the things he's written. I've never heard him speak. I understand he has an extensive vocabulary. Is that true? Okay, you will. And since we operate on the highest ethical standards during this symposium, we figured that for the sake of safety and for synodical certification, that we would have, if we can have Allah, we'll have the prophet. And if the people in the back of the auditorium would please come down, that would be greatly appreciated. So it's my honor and privilege to introduce a person I worked with at least for 9 years. I should say I worked with him and Dr. Nafsker on the CTCR, and a person I consider a very good friend, Dr. Joel Leyenbauer.
Wow, that's the first I heard of any ethical standards for this symposium. And, I haven't witnessed much either in that area, so yes, it's a joke. Thank you very much. It is a real honor and privilege for me to be with you. I have benefited greatly from both the presentations and the conversations that have taken place. In his various books and writings, Stanley Hauerwas talks a lot about the importance of friendships for living meaningful lives and for sharpening one's theological perspective. And I've actually seen that principle at work quite powerfully here at this conference. This month, I begin my 20th year on the staff of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, and I am deeply grateful for the many diverse and meaningful friendships that I've been able to develop over the years through my work with the Commission, including friendships with gifted and distinguished members of this faculty and people associated with this institution, like Cam McKenzie, the sainted Kurt Marquardt, Bill Weinrich, Dean Wenthe, Larry Rass, Chuck Geeshan, and others, including, of course, my dear friend David Scare. I have to say, however, that of all the members of the CTCR that I've been kind of exposed to over the years, David Scare was by far the most, how should I put this? By far, well, maybe after last night I'll just let you fill in the blank. I was sitting in the airport in Minneapolis a few months ago on my way to the Iowa District West Convention to speak on church and culture, a little bit on Hauerwas. Apparently, Scare doesn't go to the Iowa West District. I didn't realize that until last night. But I had worked up what I thought was a pretty snazzy PowerPoint for that presentation, and it was a new accomplishment for me. I was pretty proud of it. I was sitting in the airport reviewing it, kind of showing it off, hoping that some of the people sitting around me might notice it and kind of be impressed by it, and of course an opportunity to witness as they would notice this Christological presentation. At one point, I was glancing next to me at the woman who was sitting next to me who wasn't showing the least interest in my scintillating PowerPoint, and I happened to notice that she was reading a book with a bright yellow cover. It said, "Real leaders don't use PowerPoint." Now, without in any way meaning to render judgment on those who've gone before me here, I'm going to try to exercise my, or at least test, my leadership skills by not using a PowerPoint this morning. You're just going to have to listen. I'm pretty sure I will deeply regret that decision, but we'll see how it goes. In certain social circles of conviviality and, let's say, polite conversation, I am sometimes asked about my doctoral work, specifically the topic or focus of my doctoral dissertation. And in most cases, I can anticipate the response, even if communicated only or primarily via facial expression, when I tell people that the title of my dissertation was "The Christological and Ecclesial Passivism of Stanley Hauerwas, a Lutheran Analysis and Appraisal." More often than not, the expression says, "Who the hell is Stanley Hauerwas?" Now, if I know anything at all about Hauerwas, and I have met him and had conversations with him and shared my dissertation with him, I think he would be absolutely delighted by that kind of response, especially by the spontaneous expression of mild profanity, because as David Scare said, if you have ever heard Hauerwas speak or read even a fair sampling of his writings, you know that Hauerwas himself has an affection for peppering his theological discourse with four-letter words. And to those who are offended by his practice in this regard, his standard response is, "Sorry, that's just how us Texans talk." That's what he says. When in academic, especially theologically academic circles, someone owns up to being relatively ignorant of Hauerwas, I'm tempted to respond in Hauerwasian fashion by saying, "Where the heck have you been? Or what the heck have you been reading over the last 25 or 30 years?" Of course, Christian charity restrains me from responding in that way, and that same Christian charity constrains me to spend at least a few minutes this morning explaining who the heck Stanley Hauerwas is and why his work is so important, especially for the sake of those of you who honestly don't know or aren't totally sure. Since my assigned topic is God in public discourse, let me begin by referring to a very public recognition of Lord Stanley. In the year 2001, Time magazine took on the task of selecting America's best contributors in the areas of science and medicine, arts and entertainment, and society and culture, including in the last category, America's best theologian. The recipient of this honor was none other than Stanley Hauerwas, a United Methodist professor who earned his PhD at Yale, taught for 2 years at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, and then joined the faculty of the University of Notre Dame, where he taught until 1984. Since then, Hauerwas has taught theology and ethics at Duke Divinity School. Now, interestingly, Time chose a Lutheran scholar, Jean Bethke Elstein, to write the profile of Hauerwas that appeared in the September 17, 2001 issue of Time. She wrote as follows: "Hauerwas is contemporary theology's foremost intellectual provocateur. He has been a thorn in the side of what he takes to be Christian complacency for more than 30 years. For him, the message of Jesus was a radical one to which Christians, for the most part, have never been fully faithful. Christians, he believes, are called to be a pilgrim people, who will always find themselves in one political community or another, but who are never defined completely by it. Thus, as the body of Christ on earth, Christians must be a sign of contradiction, to borrow a term from Pope John Paul II, a moral theologian very much admired by the very Anabaptist Methodist Hauerwas." Got it? Now, without necessarily wishing to deny the accolade conferred on Hauerwas in this way, some wondered aloud at the time how the editors of Time would know who America's best theologian might be. And yet even those like Richard John Newhouse, who dared to question the theological competence of Time's editors, were also quick to acknowledge Hauerwas's status and influence in contemporary theology. Wrote Newhouse at the time, Hauerwas is the author of dozens of books, articles beyond numbering. Interviews with him and discussions about him appear in numerous academic and popular publications, making him probably the most prominent theologian in the country. Now, if you have read even a sampling of Hauerwas's essays or books or interviews, you have almost certainly encountered his passionately held views on Christian passivism and its place in the theology and life of the church. Elstein's brief article in Time calls attention to this passivist concern that surfaces in one way or another in nearly all of Hauerwas's work. She writes, Hauerwas is a volatile, complex person with an explosive personality and a high-energy style. For many, he is an unlikely pacifist. He insists that Christians should exemplify a radical message of peace. Hauerwas learned this lesson from the Anabaptist theologian John Howard Yoder. Hauerwas has respect for the position known as the just war perspective, a mode of reflection on war's occasional tragic necessity, either for self-defense or to protect those who otherwise might be slaughtered, but he insists that most Christians who claim this position are not really serious about it, or they would oppose many more wars than they do. His radical pacifism leads him to condemn any and all forms of patriotism, nationalism, and state worship, and, says Elstein, he disdains most distinctions between these positions. Now, ironically, the issue of Time, dubbing this radical pacifist America's best theologian, went to press almost simultaneously with one of the most peace-shattering days in recent American history, September 11th, 2001. The events of that day thrust our nation and others, as well as many Christians, theologians, and church bodies, into yet another complex and passionate debate about the nature and necessity of war and the best means for securing and maintaining national and global justice, peace, and freedom. In December of 2001, the editors of First Things, the editorial board of which Stanley Hauerwas had long been a member, published an editorial called In a Time of War, offering their view that the terrorist attack on September 11th constituted a bona fide act of war, placing America into the regrettable but necessary role of defender of fundamental national and even international human rights, justice, security, and freedom. The editorial goes on to offer a defense of the war against terrorism proposed by the Bush administration on the basis of the historic just war principles. It voices respect and even admiration for authentic pacifistic views with one significant caveat. One matter that has been morally muddied in recent decades, they write, should now be clarified. Those who, in principle, oppose the use of military force have no legitimate part in the discussion about how military force should be used. They only make themselves and their cause appear frivolous by claiming that military force is immoral and futile, and at the same time wanting to have a political say about how such force is to be employed. The morally serious choice is between pacifism and just war. Here, too, sides must be taken. Now, Hauerwas clearly was not a consensual participant in the writing of this editorial. His passionate dissent was published in the February 2002 issue of First Things. And while this isn't the place to discuss the details of that response, it illustrates well Hauerwas's own view of the significance of his pacifist convictions for his theology and ethics as a whole. He writes, "The editorial makes it clear that the editors regard the Christian nonviolence I represent as at best a reminder to those who are about being responsible. I may be tolerated because of my theological commitments, but my pacifism can only be regarded as an aberration that is best ignored. The arguments Yoder and I have made in an attempt to show how, listen, in an attempt to show how Christian orthodoxy and nonviolence are constitutive of one another, are quite simply not taken seriously by the editors. Harwas wonders aloud how my life may be changed by the publication of this editorialized dismissal of his conscience-bound, Christological, pacifist convictions. Should I, for example, he says, continue to be identified as a member of the editorial board of First Things? If In a Time of War constitutes the perspective of this magazine, should the editors continue to list me as a member of the board? Surely the position taken in A Time of War, he says, comes close to implying that the pacifist refusal to respond violently to injustice makes us complicit with evil and injustice and therefore immoral. A response from the editors followed in the same issue. Additional articles, responses, and exchanges ensued in subsequent months. But soon thereafter, in May 2002, Harwas did resign from the editorial board of First Things. In an article published in the June 21, 2002 National Catholic Reporter, Newhouse, chief editor, responded as follows. He said, his leaving the editorial board was entirely amicable, and I urged him not to, but I understood completely why he did. Our essential disagreement is that for my friend Stan, pacifism is the doctrine by which the church stands or falls. And I think that's not only true, I think it's dangerously schismatic, says Newhouse. And about that, we have been arguing in a friendly manner, I suppose, going on 30 years. Still, says Newhouse, Harwas is, quote, provocative, energetic, and a very, very useful person to have on the theological scene, end quote, a well-intended comment, no doubt, but one that might be interpreted as implying the very sort of patronizing dismissal of his pacifism that Harwas finds so outrageous and offensive. Harwas's project for reforming Christian ethics, with its emphasis on the virtues, character, narrative, the particularity and exclusivity of Christian ethics, and above all, the central and indispensable role of the church, the Christian community, as a sign of contradiction in and to the world, has received considerable scholarly attention in recent decades in America and beyond, and I'm going to assume that you scholarly people are somewhat familiar with that project. Far less attention, however, has been given to Harwas's pacifist convictions. And the central role, the absolutely central role, that these convictions play in his public theology as a whole. Now, that was the focus of my dissertation work, and that's what I would like to focus on here as we consider a topic that Harwas himself, frankly, might consider an oxymoron, God in public discourse. In his classic work, The Peaceable Kingdom, Harwas laments that many have viewed my pacifism with a good deal of suspicion, seeing it as just one of my many peculiarities. Statements like the following, however, confirm the seriousness of his claim that Christian orthodoxy and nonviolence are constitutive of one another. He writes, "Indeed, nonviolence is not just one implication among others that can be drawn from our Christian beliefs. It is at the very heart of our understanding of God." This is about God, this symposium. And for Harwas, nonviolence is at the heart of our understanding of God. Such a stance, he says, is not just an option for a few. It is incumbent on all Christians who seek to live faithfully in the kingdom made possible by the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Nonviolence is not one among other behavioral implications that can be drawn from the gospel, but is integral to the shape of Christian convictions. For Harwas, the phrase, a Christian pacifist, is either redundant or misleading because it seems to suggest that pacifism is just one moral choice among many for Christians. He says, I believe the narrative into which Christians are inscribed means that we cannot be anything other than nonviolent. Nonviolence is simply one of the essential practices that is intrinsic to the story of being Christian. Passivism, he says, is the form of life incumbent on those who would worship Jesus as the Son of God. For a Christian to be nonviolent, says Hauerwas, is not just another political position, it is rather at the heart of what it means to be a Christian. It is not just another moral issue, but it constitutes the heart of our worship of a crucified Messiah. It's pretty clear. One of the ways of sketching out, in a basic way at least, the contours of Hauerwas' passivism is by contrasting it to more classical or traditional positions or approaches. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the classic text on Christian attitudes toward war and peace was written by Roland Bainton, who also wrote the classic Luther biography, the popular biography, Here I Stand. I don't know about you, but when I was young and I read Here I Stand, I just kind of assumed that Bainton was a Lutheran. I mean, who else would write a biography of Luther except a Lutheran? Actually, of course, Bainton was he's a Quaker, really. And he considered himself a pacifist. In the introduction to Christian attitudes toward war and peace, he provides a nutshell summary of the basic history from his perspective. He says the early church was pacifist to the time of Constantine. And then partly as a result of the close association of church and state under this emperor, and partly by reason of the threat of the barbarian invasions, Christians in the 4th and 5th century, from Augustine, of course, took over from the classical world the doctrine of the just war, whose object should be to vindicate justice and restore peace. The just war had to be fought under the authority of the state, must observe a faith, good faith code and humanity. The Christian elements added by Augustine were that the motive must be love, and monks and priests were to be exempted. The crusade arose in the High Middle Ages, a holy war fought under the auspices of the church or of some inspired religious leader, not on behalf of justice conceived in terms of life and property, but on behalf of an ideal, the Christian faith. Since the enemy was without the pale, the code tended to break down. Now, even though Bainton himself clearly claims to be a pacifist at the end of this book, Hauerwas is far from pleased with his approach to this issue for a number of reasons. First, Hauerwas is disturbed by the very use of these categories as if pacifism, just war, and the crusade are three clearly definable and sort of equally acceptable or at least understandable Christian attitudes toward war and peace that have manifested themselves throughout history. Each of these terms, says Hauerwas, is capable of a wide variety of definitions, many of which can hardly be characterized as Christian in any sense of the term. In fact, Hauerwas often vigorously denies that he is a pacifist. If this term is understood in any number of the ways it typically is understood, for example, as just a pragmatic political strategy for ridding the world of war. To give you some idea of the complexity of this issue, John Howard Yoder has written a book called Nevertheless, in which he catalogs and describes no less than 24 distinct types of religious pacifism. He devotes the last chapter to his own brand of pacifism, the pacifism of the messianic community, which has had a large impact on Hauerwas' work. Yoder has also written a huge tome, highly touted by Hauerwas, called Christian Attitudes Toward War, Peace, and Revolution, a Companion to Bainton. And so he uses it as a way of trying to correct and supplement the inadequate work of Bainton. And the Missouri Synod actually gets some interesting treatment in that book. You gotta check it out. Now, that leads to a second reason that Hauerwas rejects Bainton's approach, namely because it doesn't come close, from his perspective, it doesn't come close to exploring adequately the reasons why the early church turned away from pacifism at the time of Constantine. Bainton mentions the barbarian invasions and the close association of church and state as if the pacifism of the early church was rooted primarily in cultural or sociological or political considerations. According to Hauerwas and Yoder, however, the stalwart pacifism of the early church was rooted primarily, even exclusively, in theological convictions. These early Christians, they say, were simply determined to be faithful to the clear words of Jesus in the Gospels about turning the other cheek, not resisting those who do evil, loving one's enemies just as Jesus loved his enemies. They understood, unlike most of us today, they say, that one simply cannot be faithful to the words and example of Jesus, especially his climactic act of nonviolence and non-resistance on the cross, and at the same time willingly and knowingly engage in obvious acts of violence. And so what happened at the time of Constantine, they say, was not simply an inevitable and theologically acceptable shift in the Christian attitude toward participation in various forms of state-sponsored violence. Rather, what happened was nothing less than apostasy, a great and terrible fall of the church into a way of thinking that confused and mixed and mingled in a kind of syncretistic heresy, loyalty to the state with its desires and demands, and loyalty to Christ with his desires and demands. And that's what Yoder and Hauerwas refer to when they talk about Constantinianism, the tragic tendency of the church ever since the time of Constantine to think that its primary job is to control history or police and improve society through control of or cooperation with the secular state. This understanding of the relationship between church and state, they insist, always involves some degree, usually a profound degree of compromise. And it almost always involves Christian participation or support of violence in a way that clearly contradicts the words and example of Christ. What Christians need to understand, says Hauerwas, is that it is not those who bear arms, but rather those who bear crosses for the sake of Christ, who are truly working with the grain or stuff of the universe. We are the ones, he says, who, despite all appearances, are promised final victory and vindication by God's power, not by our own power or our cooperation in unchristlike violence on the basis of the interests of some self-seeking state. When we compromise our convictions in order to cooperate with the state, we are showing that we really don't trust God to do what God has promised to do and what he's already done by raising up his Son in glory after Jesus faithfully refused to use violence against his enemies and instead willingly surrendered himself up to death, even though it looked like disaster in the end. After listening to this brief summary, you can probably understand why most people tend to characterize the pacifism of Yoder and Hauerwas and most forms of Christian pacifism as sectarianism, or as necessarily involving some kind of a withdrawal ethic on the part of the church. In his book, Bainton himself kind of accepts this conclusion. He says, pacifism has commonly despaired of the world and disassociated itself either from society altogether or from political life, and especially, of course, from war. The advocates of the just war theory have taken the position that evil can be restrained by the course of power of the state. The church should support the state in this endeavor, and individual Christians as citizens should fight under the auspices of the state. The crusade belongs to the theocratic view that the church, even though it is a minority, should impose its will upon a recalcitrant world. Pacifism is thus often associated with withdrawal, he says, the just war with qualified participation, and the crusade with dominance of the church over the world. And so if you're keeping score, you can mark this down as the third reason that Hauerwas doesn't have much good to say about Bainton. Because both Yoder and Hauerwas completely and absolutely reject this notion that the pacifism that they espouse involves any kind of withdrawal ethic. In fact, just the opposite is true, they say. Christians are not called by God to withdraw from society. They are called to be God's witnesses in and to a sinful world. But they are to do this not by becoming part of the world, by being co-opted by worldly causes and governments, or by imitating the politics of the world rooted in a craving for control and the exercise of violence. Rather, they are to bear witness to the peaceable kingdom of Jesus by committing themselves wholeheartedly, radically, unreservedly to what Yoder famously called the politics of Jesus. Politics as in polis, city, community. The politics of Jesus, according to Yoder and Hauerwas, is really just another name for the church. God's set-apart people who live as resident aliens in this world as they bear witness boldly and faithfully and joyfully to the nonviolent life and death of Jesus Christ. The church is to exist in the world as a radically different kind of community, they say, with a radically different set of values and practices. By virtue of its character as a community of holy, peaceable, loving, forgiving people, the church bears witness to the world by showing the world what it really looks like. How else can the world know what it looks like, except if it has the church to serve as a mirror for that purpose? The church is to serve as a contrasting model to the world's way of doing politics on the basis of power and pressure, preference and violence. There's just no way, according to Hauerwas, that the church can bear witness authentically and meaningfully to the world and at the same time make use of aspects of the politics of the world that compromise the clear words and example of Christ, especially, again, that climactic act of non-resistance. Ultimately, therefore, what makes Hauerwas' pacifism tick and what makes it unique is its inseparable connection with the unique person and work of Jesus Christ as he understands those things, and with the peaceable kingdom of Christ as it is exemplified in the body of Christ, the church. And that brings us back, full circle, to Hauerwas' project for reforming Christian ethics, which some might want to just kind of see as separate from all of this. Back in 1981, in kind of Luther-like fashion, Hauerwas proposed 10 theses for reforming Christian social ethics. These theses were meant as a direct challenge to the way mainline Protestants and Catholics in the United States and elsewhere were doing social ethics at the time, and they still stand as a significant challenge to most liberal and conservative Christian approaches to social ethics today. These theses are sometimes summarized by two pithy Hauerwasian assertions, namely, the church does not have a social ethic, the church is a social ethic. And the first political task of the church is to be the church. Now, let me read just five or six of these theses to you with Hauerwas' brief explanation. Number one, he says, the social significance of the gospel requires the recognition of the narrative structure of Christian convictions for the life of the church. Christian social ethics, he says, too often takes the form of principles and policies that are not clearly based on or warranted by the central convictions of the faith. Yet the basis of any Christian social ethic should be the affirmation that God has decisively called and formed a people to serve him through Israel and the work of Christ. The appropriation of the critical significance of the latter, the work of Christ, depends on the recognition of narrative as a basic category for social ethics. Number three, the ability to provide an adequate account of our existence is the primary test of the truthfulness of a social ethic. No society, he says, can be just or good that is built on falsehood. The first task of Christian social ethics, therefore, is not to make the world better or more just, but to help Christian people form their community consistent with the conviction that the story of Christ is a truthful account of our existence as human beings. For as H.R. Niebuhr argued, only when we know what is going on do we know what we should do. And Christians believe that we learn most decisively what is going on in the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is a theology that is almost as radically Christological as David Scares, I dare say. Number five, the primary social task of the church is to be itself. That is, a people who have been formed by a story that provides them with the skills for negotiating the danger of this existence, trusting in God's promise of redemption. The church is a people on a journey who insist on living consistent with the conviction that God is the Lord of history. Thus, they refuse to resort to violence in order to secure their survival. The fact that the first task of the church is to be itself is not a rejection of the world or a withdrawal ethic, but a reminder that Christians must serve the world on their own terms. Otherwise, the world would have no means to know itself as the world. Number six, Christian social ethics can only be done from the perspective of those who do not seek to control national or world history, but who are content to live out of control. To do ethics from the perspective of those out of control means that Christians must find the means to make it clear to both the oppressed and the oppressor that the cross determines the meaning of history. Christians should thus provide imaginative alternatives for social policy as they are released, freed from the necessities of those who would control the world in the name of security. To be out of control means that Christians can risk trusting in gifts, so they have no reason to deny the contingent character of our existence. Seven, Christian social ethics depends on the development of leadership in the church that can trust and depend on the diversity of gifts in the community. It's kind of interesting. He says, the authority necessary for leadership in the church should derive from the willingness of Christians to risk speaking the truth to and hearing the truth from those in charge. Number eight, for the church to be rather than to have a social ethic means we must recapture the social significance of common behavior such as acts of kindness, friendship, and the formation of families. It's a mistake to understand Howard Wass's pacifism as just some theory about war. For Howard Wass, pacifism is all about how we live our lives every day, moment by moment, in our families, in our communities, in our churches. Number nine, in our attempt to control our society, Christians in America have too readily accepted liberalism as a social strategy appropriate to the Christian story. Liberalism, he says, in its many forms and versions, presupposes that society can be organized without any narrative that is commonly held to be true. As a result, it tempts us to believe that freedom and rationality are independent of narrative. That is, we are free to the extent that we have no story. Think about it. Liberalism is, therefore, particularly pernicious, he says, to the extent that it prevents us from understanding how deeply we are captured by its account of our existence. And finally, number 10, the church does not exist to provide an ethos for democracy or any other form of social organization, but it stands as a political alternative to every nation witnessing to the kind of social life possible for those who have been formed by the story of Christ. Now, obviously, there's all kinds of stuff going on in Howard Wass's theology, even on a presuppositional level, with which confessional Lutherans will strongly and inevitably disagree. That seems rather shocking, because after all, he's not a confessional Lutheran. He's a Methodist. He's an Anabaptist. He's a man, as he says, without a church. He didn't know what church he belongs to. He's even got a bunch of Lutheran friends. Sometimes he thinks he's Lutheran, and then he wakes up. Yeah. There are clear differences when it comes to such central issues as the person and work of Jesus Christ, the relationship between justification and sanctification, the nature of the church, and, of course, the distinction between the two realms, which finally makes it impossible to harmonize those just war and pacifist positions. On the other hand, I am also absolutely convinced that much of what Hauerwas has to say, especially in the area of ecclesiology and the relationship to social ethics, can be very, very helpful to us as confessional Lutherans who admittedly, can we admit this? Who admittedly have some work to do when it comes to fleshing out the practical and ethical and societal and incarnational implications of a somewhat impoverished ecclesiology. And so let me share in closing just a couple of things that I believe we can learn from Hauerwas, especially in this area. First, I think we confessional Lutherans, need to take seriously Hauerwas's valid, if at times overstated, concerns about the dangers of Constantinianism and the temptation of competing loyalties, misplaced priorities, and false views of the church's responsibility for society, even as we guard against dangers on the opposite extreme. Despite the Missouri Synod's generally quietist history as a church body when it comes to social and political ethics and involvement, or perhaps, I wonder sometimes, as an overreaction to that quietist history, I'm afraid that today we are sometimes in danger of leaning toward or even embracing approaches to social ethics that really do come more from a Reformed or evangelical perspective, whether liberal or conservative. And so as we navigate through these tricky and treacherous waters, I think Hauerwas's warnings are really helpful against wrong and misplaced kinds of political activism on the part of the church. Second, I think we need to take seriously what Hauerwas has to say about the nature of the church's witness as church in and to society, as a way of responding to the very real challenge of presenting to the world a radical and, yes, peaceable alternative to the world's violence and chaos, discord and disunity. I believe that Hauerwas is right when he says the first political or social task of the church is to be the church. When it comes to his emphasis on character, on community, on the virtues, on Christian practices, not just beliefs, and the normative, not only salvific, significance of the life, sufferings, and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, there's a lot which we can learn from him, I believe. I think the question is worth asking by congregations, by institutions, by church bodies, how effectively are we as an ecclesial community demonstrating to the world, which is watching, by the very character of our community, the peace that the world lacks and is available only in and through Christ and his cross and the church? In his book, Resident Aliens, Hauerwas talks about three kinds of churches: the activist church, the conversionist church, and the confessing church. Let me quickly read this. The activist church, he says, is more concerned with the building of a better society than it is with the reformation of the church. Through the humanization of social structures, the activist church, to some extent, glorifies God. It calls on its members to see God at work behind the movements for social change so that Christians will join in movements for justice wherever they find them. It hopes to be on the right side of history, believing that it has the key for reading the direction of history or underwriting the progressive forces of history. The difficulty, he says, is that the activist church appears to lack the theological insight to judge history for itself. So its politics become kind of a religiously glorified liberalism, he says. On the other hand, he says, we have the conversionist church, and there's no doubt in my mind this is where he would place the Missouri Synod. This church argues that no amount of tinkering with the structures of society will counter the effects of human sin. The promises of secular optimism are therefore false because they attempt to bypass the biblical call to admit personal guilt and to experience reconciliation to God and neighbor. The sphere of political action is shifted by the conversionist church from without to within, from society to the individual soul. Because this church works only for inward change, it has no alternative social ethic or social structure of its own to offer the world. Alas, the political claims of Jesus are sacrificed for politics that inevitably seems to degenerate into a religiously glorified conservatism. The confessing church, says Hauerwas, is not a synthesis of the two approaches. It's not a helpful middle ground. Rather, it's a radical alternative. Rejecting both the individualism of the conversionists and the secularism of the activists, the confessing church finds its main political task to lie not in the personal transformation of individual hearts or the modification of society, but rather in the congregation's determination to worship Jesus Christ in all things. The confessing church, like the conversionist church, also calls people to conversion, but it depicts that conversion, remember he's a Methodist, but it depicts that conversion as a long process of being baptismally engrafted into a new people. There's some truth to that, though. An alternative polis, a countercultural social structure called the church. It seeks to influence the world by being the church, that is, by being something the world is not and never can be, lacking the gift of faith and vision that is ours in Christ. The confessing church seeks the visible church, an actual place, clearly visible to the world, in which people are actually faithful to their promises. They actually love their enemies. They actually tell the truth. They actually honor the poor. They suffer for righteousness and therefore testify to the amazing community-creating power of God. The confessing church has no interest in withdrawing from the world, but it is not surprised when its witness evokes hostility from the world. The church knows that its most credible form of witness and the most effective thing it can do for the world is the actual creation of a living, breathing, visible community of faith. The overriding political task of the church, he says, is to be the community of the cross. Now, obviously, we won't, as I said, be able to accept everything Hauerwas has to say about what this confessing church will look like, but I think there is a lot here that we can affirm as Lutherans who take seriously what our own confessions have to say about the church as God's holy set-apart community in the world and about the necessary relationship between the doctrines of justification and sanctification, and about how the two kinds of righteousness go hand in hand, both in our lives as individual Christians and in our life together as a church. Now, I realize that in the end, I really haven't said much about the topic, God in public discourse, directly, perhaps, haven't said much about that, but frankly, Hauerwas really doesn't have much to say about that topic either, as far as I can see, at least not as it is typically defined or understood. If you really are interested in this topic, he comes closest to addressing it directly in his contribution to the Gifford Lectures in 2001, which have been published by Brazos under the title, With the Grain of the Universe, the Church's Witness and Natural Theology. In the January 2002 issue of First Things, R.R. Reno has a very helpful review of this book, and maybe the best way to wrap up what I have to say is by sharing just the closing paragraphs of that review. Sacred politics has always been Hauerwas's preoccupation. His indifferent and inconclusive closing remarks on the role of Christianity in the contemporary university show how much more Hauerwas is concerned with the tikkun olam, healing the world, than with contemplation. The real emphasis of his conclusion falls on two witnesses to the task of faithful natural theology, a term that Hauerwas really didn't even like, John Howard Yoder and John Paul II. Of course, both no more advanced propositions in the discipline of natural theology than does Hauerwas. Instead, both provide clarity about how to take responsibility not for the world, that's God's job, but in the world. Yoder teaches us that Christianity does not need the world in order to have a body. We are given a body in Jesus Christ. To dwell in him, Yoder insists that we must resist the detaching, distancing, and spiritualizing strategies of worldly accommodation. Thus, one of Hauerwas' great themes is struck. Christianity is at its best when standing in stark contrast to the world. Nothing better hardens and solidifies the faith than galvanizing conflicts with worldly powers. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The credibility of Christianity depends on the visibility of Christian holiness, not juggling the ever-changing prejudices of intellectual responsibility. In Hauerwas's view, John Paul II teaches the same lesson, but with a twist. For John Paul II, the blood of the martyrs is also the seed of a true humanism. The world, especially our world, needs a weighty and forceful witness of faith. Thus, as John Paul II reminds us, the church does not need the world in order to have a body, but the world certainly needs the body of the church in order to be humane. In Hauerwas's view, no arguments of natural theology can give stability to modernity. Rather, we need ballast among the roiling conflicts of worldly powers. We all feel the need to stand somewhere, and that is now evident in the resurgent patriotism that has followed in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. We cannot overcome evil by adopting critical detachment, the stance of anywhere and nowhere, and yet, Jesus did not promise the Holy Spirit to the nations. Only the church, Hauerwas insists, can secure a fully and finally responsible place to stand. One can be a citizen, just as one can be a critical thinker or a scientific inquirer, but we can only assume these roles responsibly if we do so in the service of the truth. And as Hauerwas never tires of reminding us, only in the church can we reliably find the teachings and habits to guide us for such service. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take the liberty of, in regard to ethics, we are more acquainted with Richard John Neuhaus than we are with Hauerwas because of the way you presented it, it seems as if Neuhaus would fit under the Constantinian mold of actually trying to adjust the factors in government and society. And would that be the point where they had a parting of the ways?
Well, I think so. I really do think so. I think from, you know, they were friends. It was always a friendly debate. But I think Hauerwas wouldn't hesitate to characterize Neuhaus's ethics as Constantinian. I was hoping I would just leave not enough time for questions, and my plan was foiled.
I'm
kidding.
Dr. Leyenbauer,
yes.
I thank you for your message. I wondered what you said, how this might relate to Lutherans' participation signing on to the Manhattan Declaration.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have actually gotten a lot of questions in our office about that. And I think the Manhattan Declaration is a pretty fine statement. It's a pretty fine statement that obviously resonates with many of our own statements and many of our own themes and concerns. Probably its most controversial aspect is the civil disobedience piece, but we've got some documents in the CTCR, if you haven't seen them, on civil disobedience that I think also resonate with those. We're Lutherans, you know, so I'm presenting you as a kind of a challenge and as maybe as an incentive to do some more reading of Hauerwas, his views. We obviously, Lutherans, have a different understanding than Hauerwas of the distinction between the two realms. I mean, we just do. And I think there is a place for healthy debate in a church like ours about the helpfulness of various kinds of support for statements like the Manhattan Declaration. I think the risk you always run with things like that is to put yourself in the position of constantly then having to make decisions about what kinds of statements are helpful to sign or not sign as pastors, to put yourself in the position of trying to maintain a healthy objectivity in terms of your alignment, you know, with at least perceptions about a certain political party or position. But in its focus on those specific moral issues, you know, I think it's a fine statement. And I've had pastors call me and said, what do you think? And I said, well, If you feel this would be helpful in the place where you are, I don't see any problem with doing that. I've even had some circuits that have asked, could we do this as a circuit? Did I sign it? I'm not going to answer that in a public forum. No, I didn't personally sign it, but I did read it.
Lutherans typically associate ethics with the law, and you presented Howard Wass as one who doesn't follow principles so much as talk about a narrative formation. What, if anything, can Lutherans appropriate from this idea of formation to be the church? Say, for example, in what we might see as our own narratives of preaching and the sacraments.
Yeah, well, you answered your own question, because I think that's exactly the way we can do it. And those are major concerns for Howard Wass, too. Howard Wass's most recent work really are sermons, where he provides examples of how we can do what you're talking about through our preaching. And they're worth reading, these sermons. I mean, again, not always reflective of our theology, but he's also huge on the sacraments. And for him, the most visible form of the peaceable kingdom of Christ happens when we come together and share the body and blood of Christ together. I mean, a different understanding of the sacrament, but that act is critical to his understanding of what the church is all about as well. So.
Okay, thanks so much for a stimulating presentation about something I think probably most of us weren't really familiar with, so
right.
thanks for that. I'm wondering, to get to the God question, does Howard Wass's utterly nonviolent view of God lead to Marcionism? And I mean, what does Howard Wass do with God, the God of the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. Read my dissertation. I think he's very aware of that danger. He and Yoder both are. They both deny that they're Marcionist, but they have very creative, very creative ways of explaining a lot of the narratives in the Old Testament. Very Christological, God can do things maybe that we can't, but it's a great question. And even things like Jesus clearing the temple, in Romans 13, they count for that. And probably the best place to start to get a feel for that is actually to read Yoder's Politics of Jesus. I mean, he deals with it. You may not agree with it, but he deals with it better than anybody I've seen who I disagree with so strongly about it. So.
Thank you very
much. Okay.